This podcast was recorded Thursday, October 24th at 10:30 a.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this. Yeah, like Arnold Palmer will go back to being best known for his army and his iced tea lemonade drink. Just when you think the campaign cannot sink any lower. Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all those snollygosters, those shrewd politicians who are making their last pitches to get your vote. I'm Mike Thompson. Coming up in the podcast, how rare is proven immigrant voter fraud in Ohio? 0.0004%. We'll explain. But first, a dozen days remain. And the candidates for president are done with micro-targeting voters, trying to appeal with the narrowest groups of voters. They are making their final pitches. For Donald Trump, it's the economy.
Starting in January, we will give our companies the lowest taxes, the lowest energy costs, the lowest regulatory burdens, and free access to the best and biggest market in the planet. But you know, no, it will not.
For Kamala Harris, it's Donald Trump.
Imagine now Donald Trump in the Oval Office, in the Situation Room. He who has openly admired dictators, said he would be a dictator on day one. The former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has said he is a fascist to the core.
The former president wants voters to remember his time in office before the pandemic when prices were lower than they are now. The vice president wants voters to remember Donald Trump's time in office, the chaos, the politicization of the pandemic, and January 6th. And we are not sure which message is working, or maybe if both messages are working, because the race remains tied, both nationally and in every swing state. To help guide us through this final sprint, joining us is retired Ohio State University political science professor Paul Beck. Paul, welcome back to Snollygoster.
Thank you, Mike. It's really good to be on.
It has been several weeks since you were on last. Now, the race has not really changed since then. What do you make of the closeness of this race?
Well, that's really the interesting thing, is that the nation is still divided and polarized, and the polls haven't changed much in the last weeks. They certainly changed during the period when Biden had decided he would not continue in the race and then designated Kamala Harris as his replacement. And of course, that was then consolidated by the vote of the delegates to the Democratic National Convention, even before the convention itself. So that was a period where polling kind of shifted with the momentum going towards the Democrats, but by a very, very slender margin. And that's what we see right now, is the elections both nationwide, but particularly in the key swing states, the seven states that are designated as the Electoral College battleground states. Those figures haven't changed much at all, and they are almost always within the margin of sampling error.
Yeah, basically.
As a survey researcher, I'm trained to believe that if it's within the margin of error, it could be either way.
Yeah, basically, Harris has closed the gap that Biden had before he dropped out. Certainly, the gap that appeared after the Biden-Trump debate back in June.
Correct.
And she really has not really pulled away since then. The Trump Biden/Harris. It just remains tied. As you said,
yes,
we're just as divided as ever. Do you believe the polls? You know, in the past, you know, there have been hidden Trump voters out there, both in 2016 and in 2020. The pollsters missed that. In 2016, Hillary was ahead in the state polls. In 2020, Biden was ahead. And we all know Trump won in 2016, and it was much, much closer than expected in 2020.
Well, the pollsters always are trying to correct for the mistakes or the oversights of previous polls, and this means the previous presidential election polls. They correct that by weighting, how they weight respondents in these polls. These are very, very low response rates.
Yeah,
that's the nature of modern polling, at least in the United States. I was talking to a colleague of mine in another country where they're getting response rates that are 70 to 80% of the people contacted. here, it often, even for the best of polls, is below 10% or right around 10%. And so there is, you know, a very, very important weighting that takes place of people who have actually responded to the polls. You're never quite sure you've got it right until the check, and the check is the result of the election.
Yeah, it's you read these articles about how what they've done, and it's really kind of a crapshoot. It really is. I mean, I believe in polls. I believe that polls can, if done correctly, can tell us where the voters are, even with a low sampling rate. But it's mystifying. Let's get to, Mike,
what is interesting about the polls is that we all, of course, are yearning for information on the battle between the two candidates, at least in this case for president. We're always interested in knowing where things stand. And the polls are all we really have. You can look at how campaigns are raising funding. But at the presidential level, I don't think the funds that campaigns have really matter all that much because the candidates are going to be quite visible to the public. It's below the presidential level that the funding matters and can really spell the difference between losing and winning. Yeah. But the trial heats are what we're fixated on. And every day they get reported. I turn when I get up in the morning right away to take a look at the results. Polls. I shouldn't, because they don't change.
No, they haven't. And if they change like a point, that doesn't matter. It's all within the statistical margin.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let's get to the messaging. Trump, he's trying to make it about the economy, immigration to a lesser degree, but certainly about the economy. But you know, I was trying to find that soundbite that we just played of the president. He cannot stay on message. He'll start to make a point, a really poignant point about the economy and what his plan is for the economy, and then he'll go off on a tangent. He'll start criticizing Biden and Harris or talk about, you know, whatever. But that's the thing that he is, if he can stay on message, that's what he's trying to drive home, right, in these last few days.
Well, I think that his campaign staff wants him to focus on the economy and stay away from the more controversial things that he has said. He, of course, is his own man. He doesn't really listen to them. It doesn't seem anyway. And the other thing about the economy is that his position, no, I don't want to say his position, the realities of the economy have changed over the course of the campaign. Mm-hmm. The economy is in much better shape than it was a year ago. Inflation is down. That's not to say that prices have gone down. They don't go down typically. So they've stayed at a level that was elevated through the previous amounts of inflation, but they haven't increased in recent months. And then the other indicators of a sound economy are all positive, all going in the Biden administration and, of course, now the Harris campaign direction. So the issue is not what it was. I see them moving more, that is the Trump campaign, more and more to the border, to immigration, to playing that card that was so successful for him in 2016, and to a lesser degree in 2020. And then, of course, the Harris campaign has responded as more and more members of the Trump administration from the past have come out to say, look, this guy is really not fit.
Yeah, that's been interesting to watch. You know, for the first part of this month, Harris was doing a lot of biographical stuff. You know, she was appearing on podcasts, talking about her growing up with her mom and what she was doing as a prosecutor and stuff like that. She talked a lot about helping with the high cost of housing, a little bit about price gouging. But now she seems pretty laser focused on making Donald Trump the issue. Take this week's CNN town hall with undecided voters. She pretty much avoided answering every question but one.
Do you think Donald Trump is a fascist?
Yes, I do.
There it is. She can answer a question, Paul, right there. She just didn't even hesitate. She answered the question directly, something she has not done, something that a lot of politicians don't do. But what do you make of this? She really seems to be focused now in this last few days on this fitness for office. You know, the Trump administration folks coming out saying he's unfit, saying he's a fascist. What do you make of that strategy?
Well, I think it's a strategy that may prove to be a winning strategy. The fact that there are so many Republican leaders, people who were leaders within his own administration, who know him well, and are testifying to the authoritarian tendencies that he showed back then, and is suggesting that he would pursue, if reelected in 2024. We need to, I guess, believe what he says there, even though there are a lot of things that he says that we probably shouldn't believe.
Yes, I mean, John Kelly, the interview came out this week. From what I understand, he gave an interview with The Atlantic and The New York Times. Reporters have been asked after him for several years to go on the record and say what he feels about former President Trump, and he did it in the last 13 days of the campaign, last 14 days of the campaign. I don't think that's coordinated with the Harris campaign, but she took advantage of it.
Oh, she certainly did. And what's important, by the way, about the Kelly interviews is that they have them on audio. So it isn't that they are being filtered through the media. It's rather that he speaks directly there. And of course, we're going to see that in the Harris campaign ads in the next 2 weeks, leading up to the election itself. We talk about leading up to the election, leading up to election day, but it's important to realize that a considerable chunk of voters have already voted or will have voted before we get to November the 5th. And so the effects of the campaign, of course, are lost on them. But there are voters who are still maybe weighing their choices. And the concentration of the ads on both sides is going to be on trying to win them over, although really more probably trying to mobilize their base, get voters who are not yet or who have not yet cast a vote, but are going to vote in your way, you think, make sure you get them to the polls.
Let's talk first about the trying to get motivation. You look at now, Liz Cheney's been campaigning with Kamala Harris this week, urging conservative, namely conservative women, to vote for Donald Trump, vote against Donald Trump, to vote for Kamala Harris, and even telling them point blank that, you know, your vote is secret. You don't need to tell anybody, you know, your husband, your friends, who you voted for. And the sort of never Trumper Republicans who may agree with him on the economy, may agree with him on what he said about lower regulations and lower taxes for corporations, but just don't like the guy. That's who Harris is trying to sway right now, do you think?
Oh, yes, I think very much so. And we've already seen a lot of slippage among Republicans. The figures that I saw most recently in a poll is that, well, let me state it a different way. Democrats vote for Democrats, Republicans vote for Republicans, but not all of them. And we see now more slippage among Republicans than we see among Democrats, slippage being in the direction of voting for the other party's candidate. If Harris is able to pull away more of the people who ordinarily would vote Republican, she's going to win the election. Some of them may decide just to stay home, or some of them may decide not to vote at the presidential level, but to vote down ticket. That's happened in the past, by the way. Not everybody votes for president, though most people do, obviously, because that's the marquee contest. But sometimes there are people who simply are undecided for, on the presidential ticket, but are very much decided on the Senate race or the congressional race in their district and so on.
You know, watching the town hall on CNN this week, as a journalist and as a political junkie, I was, again, frustrated that, Kamala Harris really didn't answer questions. I mean, she had voters asking her very specific questions, about U.S. policy on Israel, about, immigration. Anderson Cooper really pressed her on what would you do differently from the Biden administration, and she wouldn't answer them. Smart politically, because she wanted to focus just on this whole fascist theme, and that was the story that came out of that event. So politically, that was her strategy, and she succeeded there. But the complaint is we don't know her. She hasn't separated herself from a very unpopular president. Might there be regrets that she didn't do more of that? Now, she hasn't had much time, but she's had some time.
Well, the other thing to say is that the tendency is for a vice presidential, a candidate who's been vice president, not to dump on the administration that she's a part of. And if she were to do more of that, there would be criticism of her being disloyal being somebody who really is not in the Biden camp, and that might hurt her among Democrats. Mm-hmm. On some of the issues, you know, you think of the Israel-Gaza issue. This is a really tough issue for a Democratic president, maybe for any president, because Biden has been a friend of Israel throughout his entire career. Most Jews in the United States are still going to vote Democratic, and he certainly doesn't want to alienate them. Netanyahu hasn't helped in that I think he's taken advantage of the unwillingness of Biden to push much harder against Israel, even though he's been very critical of Israeli policy, as in my view he should be. But he doesn't want to go too far. And I think Harris is in a bind that she could say, I'm not Biden, and she said that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, on some of the things that are clear Biden policies, clear administration policies, she is really not going to pull away from him, both for political reasons and for reasons that a vice president typically is loyal to their president, although Mike Pence obviously is an exception to that.
Yeah, and she's certainly not going to do it with a week and a half to go. Just think, if she had said last night when Anderson Cooper said, should you have tightened up the border in 2022 or 2023? Had she said, yes, in hindsight, we should have done that, that would have been the story today. Instead of Donald Trump is unfit for office, which is the story today. She answered one question last night, is Donald Trump a fascist? Instead of getting into immigration policy, I mean, from a political messaging standpoint, while we find it very frustrating as close observers, she wants to get the message out to people who aren't observing as closely as we are. And that was the strategy last night.
Well, maybe the other thing to say is that even though there's a lot of criticism of her as to not specifying exactly what she would do as president, I think we know what she would do as president by and large. It would be, if anything, incremental differences, incremental changes in what the Biden administration has done. Maybe what she should have said last night is that we continue to look at the immigration situation, at the border situation. We will continue to see if we can use tools to try to improve that situation, to cut down on the amount of illegal crossings mm-hmm. that occur. But remember, and she said this in the past, remember that we did have a partial solution in our hands a few months ago that had been negotiated in the Congress that we were really ready to sign on to in the administration itself. And ex-President Trump scuttled that mainly because he wanted that as an alive issue that he could campaign on in the 2024 presidential race. And she's said that before. That's probably the right position to take because it looked like there was kind of an unprecedented agreement on what should be done about the border. It again was undermined by the Trump campaign and Trump himself.
And that was the tack she took on CNN is, look, we were hoping Congress would solve this with a permanent solution, and it didn't happen. And they were forced to do what they did in the past year. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the U.S. Senate race and spend a couple of minutes on issue one, the redistricting amendment. We'll be right back.
The candidates for November are set.
Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Paul Beck from Ohio State University on Sonali Gosther today. Paul, Bernie Marino and Sherrod Brown, not much polling on this race, but it looks like this is still pretty tight. As we would expect here in Ohio, with the increasingly going towards the red, and Sherrod Brown being a very popular incumbent, abortion has become the issue in these final days. And Bernie Marino told the Washington Times this week that he was kind of complaining that Brown is weaponizing abortion. I don't know why he would be surprised by that, because that has been the big issue in the state for the past 2 years, really. And he said there's no, he's not going to push for a federal abortion ban because there's no way to get it passed because of the filibuster. What do you think will be the difference in this race, Paul, as we come down the stretch?
Well, I think abortion is going to be a big issue. There are a lot of people who are going to vote based on their position on that issue. Of course, Ohio voters have spoken on that issue with the constitutional amendment that was passed in 2023. And I think that you know, Marino has had problems with that issue and has said things maybe in the primary when he was contesting for the nomination that he no longer wants to say in the general election campaign, but he's sort of stuck there. And the Brown campaign is going to use that against him, obviously. The other thing I think about that contest is that Sherrod Brown is a liberal Democrat, may not fit the Ohio electorate as closely as he might fit the electorates in some other states, more blue states. On the other hand, he's somebody who I think has been given a lot of credit by Ohio voters who might not otherwise vote for a Democrat for Senate because of his, I'll call it his authenticity, that he doesn't split hairs. He's less a politician in a way than some other candidates might be. Now, whether that's going to carry him to a reelection or not, we will see. The polls show this to be a very close contest. It's going to depend, as the presidential contest will, not so much in Ohio, but elsewhere. It's going to depend on turnout. And I think the Democrats in Ohio have a really good ground game, better ground game than the Republicans have. And if the ground game is able to turn out people who might not otherwise vote, that's going to be a real plus for Brown. Yeah. But what Moreno, of course, has going for him is the Trump endorsement.
Yeah.
And it could well be the case that's the only thing that really is going to stand out in voters' minds, because Moreno's never been in politics before, or he's never been in a campaign before, you know, at least in the general election, and has not been active on the political stage. So it's hard to know really what he would do, aside from the fact that he has really allied himself with Donald Trump.
Yeah, Bob Taft, former governor, endorsed Sherrod Brown this week, which kind of is surprising a bit, saying Sherrod Brown has done a lot for the Dayton area where Bob Taft is now, and he's from Southwest Ohio. So it's one ticket splitter, Paul. There are probably others out there. Issue one, is the redistricting amendment that would create a 15-member commission independent of politics. The ballot language is causing confusion. Ohio Public Radio this week talked to a woman from a suburb of Columbus who says she supports that 15-member commission, but because the ballot language said voting yes will lead to gerrymandering, she voted no, and then later learned that she voted against what she had thought and regretted her vote. So there is one case of confusion. You have to figure there's a few more out there. How big of an issue will this be, what voters see when they go in to vote?
Well, the question will be what they see. And I voted early, and my memory is that you had to click on a link to the ballot language to be able to read it.
Yeah.
My guess is that most people will not click on that link, will vote the way they think going in, and will probably vote yes, as they have at least two times in the past. And I think that Ohio voters may be tired of the old system and are ready to go to a new system. No system is perfect. No set of procedures is perfect. This one, as I read the amendment, and I read the whole amendment, is not even going to come close to producing any kind of gerrymandered districting scheme. And the thing that should be emphasized, and maybe the campaign should have emphasized, the Yes campaign should have emphasized more than they did, is that this really forces a compromise between Democrats and Republicans and independents who are on that commission, because it takes two votes from each of those groups to be able to agree upon a map.
Yeah.
And compromise is important. I happen to be a believer that the present system, because it undermines competition, is really problematic, and that we should be trying to emphasize competition, which really serves voters better because it means that you and I have more choice in most of the districts rather than facing almost no choice in districts that are created on the Democratic and especially the Republican side to be safe districts. So I think the ballot language was meant to confuse. It certainly is going to confuse people who take a careful look at it. Whether it will confuse them enough to move them away from what looks like almost a 60-30 split in how voters would vote, at least according to recent polls, it remains to be seen. But I think it won't. I think voters in Ohio are upset enough at the defiance that the Republican supermajorities have shown to both the Ohio Supreme Court and to the passage of constitutional amendments in recent years that would promote some kind of different way of map making and redistricting. I think they're enough irritated by that that they're going to go ahead and vote yes on issue one.
Yeah, I've been watching to see if the supporters of issue one would take on the issue of the ballot language head on, and they really haven't. They have hinted in their ads and in their statements that that politicians are lying to you about what the amendment means, and that's as far as they have gone. So they must figure that by trying to take on and be more blunt about how don't trust the ballot language might lead to more confusion when folks get in there and draw more attention to it. As you said, you have to click on that link to see the ballot language if you vote electronically. If you vote by mail, you might see more of the language.
But that's right, yes.
Yeah, my guess is they just didn't want to give any more credence to the bad ballot language in their mind than what they already had done. Anyway.
Yeah, I think that sometimes the best strategy is not to make a particular issue salient to voters. And the issue of gerrymandering under issue one versus gerrymandering under the old system is not one that they want voters to heavily ponder.
Yeah.
And they may be right in that sense.
Yeah, I know the supporters of issue one are worried about it, though. They are nervous about the language, and but they have the money, and they're running the ads, and they have the advantage there, and that's where that they're banking on that to push their cause forward as we get close to Election Day. Paul Beck, retired Ohio State University political science professor. Always good to talk to you. Get your perspective.
Thank you, Mike. Good to talk to you.
Take care.
Bye now.
Time now for our Snollygoster of the Week segment, where we honor the shrewdest politician or political move of the past 7 days. And this week, we give it to Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost, who held a news conference this week to announce that his office had secured grand jury indictments against 6 Ohio immigrants for voting illegally. 6 people were lawful residents, but not citizens, when prosecutors say they voted in elections from 2014 to 2020. The total number of counts of illegal voting was 7. One person was indicted on 2 counts of voting illegally. Yost says irregularities like this are rare, and this is a small number of cases. That is quite the understatement. As I said, he has charged 7 counts of illegal voting. If you total up all of the votes cast in Ohio in elections between 2014 and 2020, you come up with at least 19 million votes cast. 19 million. 7 counts of immigrants voting illegally. That comes out to 0.00004%. So for literally finding 7 needles in millions of acres of haystacks and bringing attention to them 2 weeks before the election, Dave Yost gets our Snollygoster of the Week Award. Oh, one more thing. It turns out one of the guys that was indicted died 2 years ago. That's according to the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor. That'll do it for this week's edition of Snollygoster, which is part of the NPR network. As always, please be sure to leave us a good review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and just tell your friends about us. For our student producer, Katie Genius, our digital producer, Michael DeBonis, and our audio engineer, Dalton Jones, I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.